This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tonight, Pride Night at Fenway Park, and as part of the celebration, Boston culinary icon and proud LGBTQ advocate Tiffany Faison will be throwing out the first pitch. Faison, who recently won Food Network's third season of Tournament of Champions, was the first openly gay competitor on Top Chef back in 2006. She's been a vocal supporter of LGBTQ rights throughout her incredible run, and it has been incredible, of culinary success ever since. And not only that, but she's here in Studio 2 with us now. Tiffany, welcome back.
Tiziana, hi. It's so nice to be here with you.
It is great to have you. So last time we talked to you, one of the things that we talked about is how important Boston is to your identity. So I have got to believe that tonight feels big for you.
I can't even process what tonight is and what, like, I've been letting it kind of come in waves, or else I think it's just going to overwhelm me to the point of either not being able to function or crying or something. You know, I just, I'm just trying to let it in little pieces, little bites at a time. And it's, every time I let myself think about it, I just think, I can't believe this is my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you find out? What did they call you? Did you get an email? And what was your reaction when you first got the request?
A couple of members of my team reached out and they said, we think this might be an option. And I said, this is not real. Like, you guys, come on. Like, and I was in a place where I sort of thought, like, please don't tell me that this could be a thing on the, like, you know, the disappointment of, like, it not happening.
And if it's not a thing.
Exactly. It's not like I'm going to go in the corner and cry. But, yeah, and then it came through, and they said, "Hey, chef, they're inviting you onto the mound for Pride Night." And so, to be able to throw out the first pitch at Fenway Park alone is such an honor. It's, you're in rarefied air at that point. The ask is just, it's a blow away moment to even be asked, and then to do it on Pride Night, to be surrounded by, you know, members of my LGBTQIA community in Boston. It's just, I'm never at a loss for words, and I'm very clearly at a loss for words.
So let's do both pieces of that, and I'm going to stay with the throwing of the pitch for just a minute longer. Like,
my hands are getting sweaty talking about it.
So how's your gun? Right? Have you been practicing? Can you get it over the plate? Is, like, are you somebody who can throw more than one pitch, or is it just chuck that ball and get it as far as you can?
I am the lesbian that was an All-American cheerleader. I am the only lesbian I know that didn't play softball. So I wouldn't say I'm, like, a great ball player, but I've been practicing a little bit. I'm surrounded by a bunch of great softball players. We're going to leave here and go practice before tonight again. You know, this is so one of the greatest things about, I live in the Fenway, and one of the greatest things about being in Boston, I think moments like this happen. I was practicing behind the restaurants, and all of a sudden Matt Bennett walks up, and I hadn't met him. He owns Bennett's Sandwich Shop, and so we, you know, own businesses in the neighborhood. He played for the Sox for 3 years, and he was like, "Hey, you want some pointers?" And I was like, "Yes, Matt, I do." It was great.
Were they helpful? Did he
very improve? Very helpful.
So what was one?
It was a lot about how to shift my weight. It was about how to hold my left arm, righty. So how to hold my left arm kind of as a measure and, you know, kind of pointer. Mm-hmm. I was letting go where the ball was, like, really going high and right, and he kind of helped me get it over home plate. I mean, I wouldn't say get it over home plate. The goal is to not drop the ball
there,
or, like, super embarrass myself. So my girlfriend sent me, like, a video of everyone that's, like, really bonked it. Not everyone, but it was, like, major. Like, Michael Jordan screwed it up. He played for the White Sox.
Yeah, that's impressive, actually.
Everyone's like, just don't do what 50 Cent did.
Yeah. Like, wait, I don't know. What did 50 Cent do? Did he drop it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We don't want to do that.
Yeah.
All right, so let's pick up the second half of this, which is, it is important to you to be doing this on Pride Night.
It is.
And you have broken ground in a lot of areas, but one of them was being an openly gay competitor.
Yep.
That was 2006. It was a long time ago.
Long time ago.
Steps forward, steps back since then. Do you feel like we're in a different place than we were when you were breaking that ground then?
I do. It's so interesting, and I think back about this. Top Chef had me listed as bisexual. Like, I didn't even have the advocacy, or they didn't reach out or clear it with me. That is not how I identified. It was so interesting. Even through that, I think there's a conversation about how do you identify both in terms of sexuality and gender representation and presentation. So we know better now. We're very lucky to live in a city and I work in an industry that is overwhelmingly accepting and creates space, I think, for a lot of people, not just in the LGBTQIA community, but people of color and different gender representation. So I think I'm very lucky to exist and live in that community. But it exists through people being intentional about creating it. So yes, it's different. Do we still have a long way to go? And I'm, like a lot of people, terrified right now to see kind of what's happening in our country, this pendulum swing back to like the very far right. So I'm concerned about marriage equality being on the table again, and I'm concerned about the violence that we're seeing against non-binary and trans representing people, and against lesbians and gays in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. So, you know, yeah, we're in a different place, but I joke that, you know, I don't want everyone to be gay, but I want everyone to be gay, until we're in a place where like it really doesn't matter and people, you know, I want people to come out. I think representation is important, but there's a huge part of me that's like, it shouldn't even matter. People shouldn't have to come out anymore. We're in a different place, but unless I'm just a human, like unless everyone can live absolutely freely and without any sort of fear or feeling of otherness or differentness, we're not there yet.
So, you know, you've always been a powerful presence as a woman, a powerful woman, but you are now increasingly powerful as well, as a woman, as a chef. How do you think about what you want to do in this space with your burgeoning power?
That's an incredible question. I don't know that I think about it as power all the time. I think about it as representation. And it has to be, for me, it's about walking the walk. And I've always done that. And now it's done in a, you know, doing it in a way that is that much more public. So it's not that I have to be perfect. It's okay. I can be human. But I notice a lot of leaders in different communities that do the, like, you know, women to the front, queer people to the front, and they don't live it. And it is really important for me that we live it together, that I am someone who, you know, says what I mean, and then I back it up in every possible way in every corner of my life. So that's really important to
me. So give me an example of how you live it.
It's important for me that everyone that comes into my company, we talk about this all the time. You cannot do a good job at anything unless you show up as exactly who you are, right? If you're trying to hide a part of you, or you're not feeling like you're standing on your own 2 feet solidly, it's very difficult to be good at what you do. And I think the power that we have as humans in any community is being excellent at the thing that we choose to be excellent at. Like, yes, I'm gay. Is that the best thing about me? No. Is that the most interesting or the thing I'm the best at? No. I wanted to be a really incredible chef. So I can only be the best chef I can possibly be by being able to be entirely me at every turn. So providing that and continuing to fight for that in my company and in the things that I do and the representation that I have in the world. And I know that sounds really basic and elementary, but it's not. I think in my company, it's interesting, like not everyone fits in because they come to the company and they're used to more aggressive, abusive situations. And they find comfort in that. And when they come in and get to know who we are as a company and start working in our spaces, and we are not that, and we're not just like, you know, words about how to behave and we have to behave and live that way, where we're not insulting each other and we're holding each other up and we're supporting each other, it becomes hard for people. It becomes intimidating and it becomes antithetical to like it becomes what they think they wanted, and then living in it becomes very different. Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to keep people because they want to revert back to like the abuse that's rampant in our industry, and somehow that feels, you know, like a comforting place to be. And so working that out of our restaurants is first and foremost one of the things that I do. And then just being an advocate for my community and making sure that I give back to the community that has held me up for the last, I don't know how long I've been out. I was 19. I'm still 22. But for the last 20 plus years. So it really is about continuing to give back to the community. And people say giving back and like, what does that mean? But it means being an advocate and being someone who is never wavering for my community.
And one last question on this. Do you feel like the Boston restaurant scene is showing up and supporting the LGBTQ community the way it should, or is there work to do there?
There's always work to do. I think we're good at it in a lot of ways. There are a lot of really incredible gay leaders in the Boston restaurant scene that I'm very proud of, and they're very out and they're very outspoken. Yes, it's interesting. One of the things that I sort of struggle with a little bit, especially it's Pride Month, and I've been a little reticent this year to like talk about Pride. It's so deeply personal for me, and it is something that I celebrate outwardly. But I think we're missing something in terms of, and I don't expect it to manifest always in this way, but when I see other community movements that have happened that have been really powerful, Black Lives Matter, AAPI, Pride, that there's a want to go in and support the people that are owning those restaurants in ways that are meaningful and financially solvent for those restaurants. And I don't always see that with Pride. I see, and I'm thrilled for allyship and I appreciate it, but I see a lot of restaurants that are not owned by people in the LGBTQIA community throw the rainbow flags up, come in, we're having a party. Where's that money going? You know, where's the benefit? And restaurants are hurting right now. So I'm 100% in support of everyone being as financially solvent as they can by almost any means necessary. But I do think that there is an obligation for all of our community, if you're supporting the LGBTQIA community, really do seek out restaurants that are owned by LGBTQIA individuals that, like, we can, you know.
Do you want to give a couple shout-outs?
Yeah, absolutely. So ours, obviously, all of my restaurants. The Boston Urban Hospitality, which is Brian Pacini's group, they're all owned by LGBTQIA members. He owns his restaurant group, and he gives back to his community in giant ways. Yeah, there are a ton. So I think it's worth your time.
All right.
Yeah.
So last time you were here, you had just finished winning a show.
Yeah.
We had a great time talking about that. But you have another show coming up, Food Network. It's called Beachside Brawl.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, it's so much fun. We filmed it in the spring in Redondo Beach. So it's Antonia LaFaso is hosting it. She's a host and a judge. And then the way it works is there are two teams, East Coast team, West Coast team. Brooke Williamson mentors the West Coast team. I have the East Coast team. And it's this, you know, which side of the country is better? Is it east? Is it west? And we're cooking outside next to the beach, and it's six episodes. So it starts this Sunday, the 19th. I think it's on at 10 o'clock. And it's just, we had a ball filming it. It really was the most fun. So it whittles down to a winner, obviously, culinary competition. It was so much fun. And to be able to represent the East Coast and kind of the back and forth of, you know, which coast is the best coast. We had a ball. I hope everyone loves it as much as we loved filming it.
I want to give listeners a little flavor of that East Coast, West Coast. So here's a little bit of a clip from the trailer.
But here's the question. Which coast does summer food the best? Welcome to the Redondo Beach Pier. For the next 6 weeks, two culinary icons, one from the east,
that's how we do on the East Coast,
and one from the west,
feeling the heat, huh?
We'll each lead a team.
Come on, East Coast, let's go!
You need to get on that.
Of elite chefs through beachside battle.
Go!
In order to answer that question, once and for all.
Once and for all, what did you learn about the difference between East Coast and West Coast cooking?
It's interesting. I think, you know, fundamentally, the cooking is the same, right? And we had a lot of questions that actually kind of opened this can of worms of, like, what is East Coast versus West Coast cooking? And, you know, there was a lot of West Coast conversation about, well, we're farms and we're incredible vegetables and we're this and we're that. We are, too. We have beautiful farms and incredible produce and vegetables. California gets avocado. Okay, we'll give that to the West Coast.
Kind of popular right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's having a moment. It was, and we sort of really started digging into the difference between East and West Coast cooking. Stylistically, there are some differences, but I think there are so many similarities as well. We really, when we started digging into the East Coast, we went to the Caribbean. It wasn't just like what we think of the East Coast. We thought about New Jersey. We thought about, at one point, we did, you know, go to the Cape really hard, like that sort of, you know, New England cooking. We thought a lot about, like, up and down the coast. So it was fun. It was interesting to see the West Coast unfold. There was a lot of Hawaii. There was a lot of, like, you know, sort of high acid, really fresh food. It was great to see both represented and how it came out in ways that surprised, I think, both Brooke and myself and Antonia and our teams.
All right. So before I let you go, I do want to talk about the fact you are Boston through and through, Fenway Park tonight, but I understand you are a Celtics fan.
I am a Celtics fan.
So have you been watching the series?
I have. The last game, we were actually at the James Beard Awards on to a Monday night. So yeah, I need Steph Curry to, like, go. I need him to take a nap.
You want him to go away?
No, I don't need him to go away. I love watching him, but I need the Splash Brothers to maybe just stay okay. in the pool.
Okay, I wanted to talk Celtics, but I am distracted by the fact that you can casually say, yeah, I missed the last game. I was at the James Beard Awards.
Oh, don't worry, I didn't win.
I know, but still, you said at the beginning of this conversation that being invited to throw out that first pitch was, this is your life now.
Yeah.
Right? And you're talking about, I was at the James Beard Awards and we shot this show in Redondo Beach. Are you pinching yourself?
Oh, yeah. Every morning I wake up and I think it's a house of cards. Like, it's just, I keep waiting for it to all be over. Yeah. Yeah. I'm so grateful for it. I can't believe this is my life. Like, I couldn't have dreamed this. And I don't know. I hope that we're just getting started.
All right. I'm just going to end it there because that's perfect. Boston culinary icon Tiffany Faison. She's throwing out the first pitch at Fenway Park tonight as part of Pride Night. And she'll be starring on the new Food Network show. Can't even get it out. I'm so excited. Beachside Brawl. First episode premieres Sunday night, 10 p.m. Tiffany, love having you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Really fun to have you.
And so nice to be here.
Good luck tonight. Get it over the plate.
Woo!
Straight on.
I'm going to try.
All right. It is time for our regular segment, Be Well, where we focus on your wellness and ours. And today, a positive body image. One of the challenges of summer can be actually less clothing, whether it's a swimsuit on the beach or just shorts and a tank top. And in our body-conscious, thin-focused culture, that can create a lot of pressure on people. At the same time, we're evolving in our understanding of what it means to be fat, obese, thin, thin enough, healthy, unhealthy, and that there is no perfect body. And we want to talk about that today. The complicated relationship between health, weight, and how we see ourselves. So we start with Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford, physician, scientist of obesity medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And she is one of the leading researchers in the field of obesity. Dr. Stanford, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
So I'm glad to have you. And I just want to start by asking you, what is a healthy body? How do we even define what a healthy body is?
You know, I think that when we think about a healthy body, we do focus on size and, you know, your introduction to really focus on that. But I really think we need to think about, you know, being more, you know, beyond the aesthetics of an individual, right? You can't look at a person and look at their size and know what their overall health status is. And so a healthy body is one that has great cardiometabolic health. And by that, I mean, you know, has a good cholesterol value, has good blood pressure, has good liver enzymes, you know, these types of things that really will determine our propensity to chronic diseases such as obesity or type 2 diabetes or heart disease, et cetera. But in order to really evaluate that, right, we have to go beyond skin deep. And I think that what we typically do is we see an individual, we assume that their health status is one way or another just by looking at them and not doing any type of deep dive to really get the true answer.
All right, so I'm going to bring in our second voice here. Here in the studio, we have Rachel Estapa. She is a plus-size wellness influencer and the founder of More to Love Yoga, a studio that caters to plus-size people. Rachel, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So I saw you nodding a lot as Dr. Stanford was talking there, and I want to ask you what resonated so deeply with you about what Dr. Stanford said.
Having this conversation maybe 15 years ago would be unheard of, that we can come to a bigger, broader conversation around what it means to be healthy, but more importantly, what it means to live in a larger body and going through the trials and tribulations around identifying as yourself, among terms like obesity or terms like diseases. So I resonate deeply with the dual edge of this being part of the conversation. And also there are people like me, like others that have lived what the doctor is talking about, the ups and downs of blood work results, the ups and downs of numbers describing your worth, your value, and taking things a bit deeper into the self, that there's so much work in our population, in our society, to be done and to help guide that. That's really what my work is about.
So, Dr. Stanford, I'll turn back to you here, and I'm really struck by something you said, and Rachel picked it up thematically just now, which is reframing what we mean by health. And I heard you really call out that we have a visual history of deciding what's healthy. How did we get there, and what do we need to do? Help me, right? What do I need to do to change that conversation?
Well, you know, unfortunately, our idea of like weight bias or weight stigma, our propensity towards leanness and thinness as being the norm, really starts really early in life. If you look at studies, we show that weight bias begins on average at 32 months of age. Mm. Notice I didn't say anything beyond that, 32 months of age. So I want you to think back to your toddler years. And so then people wonder, well, like how they're influenced by, you know, with regards to their weight status. It comes from our parents. It comes from our caregivers. And often when I say this to parents, they are, you know, struck and they say, well, you know, I never say anything negative. And I said, it's also what you're not saying. For example, let's say you're watching television with your child or not, you know, maybe they're walking through the room and you only comment positively on people that are lean or thin and say, oh, wow, look at how amazing they look. And then you don't say anything negative about people that, let's say, have obesity, have excess body weight, but you don't say anything at all. And so the message that's being received by that child that then becomes an adult that then decides that thinness is, you know, what our beauty and culture standards abide by is governed by what their early life exposures are. So, like, when I'm looking at, you know, this disease that is obesity, we come into this idea of, like, what does that mean? And why do I call it a disease? And what we have to recognize is that obesity is a where we have excess adipose or fat tissue. And that's governed by how the brain actually regulates weight. We have two primary pathways down our brain by which we regulate weight, one which tells us to eat more and store more, and one that tells us to eat less and store less. And notice I didn't say willpower at all in that conversation.
Right.
That has nothing to do with how the brain decides to interact with our different organs and express either an excess body weight or one that does not have excess. But when I look at this excess, I have to go beneath the surface. So if a patient comes to me with obesity based upon what the screening tool tells me, like, oh, okay, they have this heightened weight, I need to look below the skin surface and say, what is their actual health status? Because I have patients that are 300 pounds that have health that is significantly superior to those that may weigh 150 pounds. But if I were to just look at them, the assumption would be, right, based upon what we're taught, that that person with 150 pounds must be significantly healthier than the person at 300 pounds. So let's go beneath the surface. Let's look at the whole person. Let's look at the overall health and determine what their health is without just, you know, I guess, focusing on just the size alone as the key factor.
So, Rachel, I'm going to bring in a listener voice here and then give you a chance to react. So we reached out to members of our subtext group here to give them a chance to share thoughts and comments. And listeners, if you want to join that group, you can text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's text the word Boston to 617-766-0382 to join our text group. A couple of them actually then left us voicemails, and I want to share one. She asked us not to use her name, which I think is indicative of how intense this conversation is. She's from Arlington. Here's a piece of what she told us.
I work in a school where very lean, healthy 8-year-olds complain of having thighs that are too big and being mocked for that. I grew up in the 70s and 80s when most all mothers and teens were on diets together, no matter their size. For many girls, this is the genesis of an eating disorder. As for me, I've suffered the collateral damage through all of these forces. Despite being a thin adolescent, I followed the expectation of very restrictive eating. So let's just say that as I feel the warm breeze of summer, it saddens me deeply that my first response relates to the panic of having to remove layers of clothing and my body being seen.
And what she brings in there, Rachel, is then this last piece, which is body image, self-image. And I know this is something you think a lot about. So reflect on what you just heard.
Yeah, I don't just think about it. I live it. I've lived it since my first memories of a doctor's appointment when I was 6 years old and I was told I was too big. And how that set off, as she called it, the collateral damage of yo-yoing, being both a good kid, quote unquote, good kid, against the realities of your body changing and people around you, doctors, teachers, peers, family members, not really sure what to do about it other than change. And that message of change, it starts early. And when I hear people, because this is not an uncommon thing that I hear from people as mothers, as parents, as people still on the path of healing and recovery, or maybe not even at that point yet, I hear exhaustion. I hear a true heart belief that we want to be good. We want to feel good. And we want to let those things be determined more on our own visceral experiences than the annual checkup with a doctor. And here's where I may split from our other guest, just purely on the sense that we are more whole than what these systems in our bodies are. And I'm from the yogic background, where I believe that systems and how our bodies interact is far more complex and nuanced than just today I have this cholesterol level and tomorrow I don't. And this absolutism that, you know, is the strength of the medical community, when it comes to the individual lived experience of being in a body that you feel is judged from the get-go before you even had a chance, it is so and consuming for yourself, your identity. You start to question, am I seeing things differently? Am I experiencing things completely wrong? And that is a core issue of a human being, regardless of what your size is, regardless of what your weight is. And that softness that I can hear in the caller's voice of, believe me, I care. I care about these topics. I care about health and well-being, but it's going to look different because my body is not your body. My body is not what the BMI standard is. And if anything, this type of conversation of starting to peel back the scientific realm of this, the hardcore facts, well, there are people that live these things, you know. Like I said, as a youth, being on diets in college and beyond, over-exercising to the point of pain, to the point of damage, that's not body, that's not health, that's not acceptance.
Dr. Stanford, I'm sure you want to react to that and build on it. So let me turn back to you.
Yeah, I think I'm actually good. I think that the other caller is unaware of like my background and my commitment to this work beyond just, you know, what the cholesterol values and things show. So what we do know is that obesity is a complex, multifactorial disease where environment, development, behavior all play a role in a person's likelihood of having this disease. And we look at the contributors to obesity. We know that there are over 100 factors, everything from racism. So the highest group of, in terms of obesity, in terms of the highest propensity is Black women. Racism, we know, is a major issue and a stressor. We know that increase in stress, the stress that I was hearing from the caller, stress that I'm hearing from the person that called in earlier, also reflect a storage of adipose tissue. Adipose is an organ that interacts and causes a cascade of negative things within the body. We know the number one risk factor for both morbidity and mortality surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic, unfortunately, was this disease that we call obesity. And the factors that cause it outside of issues like trauma or things like stress or a disordered eating, which then, of course, defends a higher set point, age-related changes, which are common in women's lives, where at the onset of menarche, when we first get our menstrual cycle, pregnancy and menopause, we see major weight shifts. We see weight bias and stigma leading to increased weight status and increased issues with that. Thermogenesis, which is how much the body burns at rest and with activity, and the gut microbiota, the bacteria in the gut of individuals that are lean versus those that have obesity, differ quite drastically. So we know this is a complex disease. When I'm working with patients that range in age from 2 to 90, my goal is to find out what are the different factors. And for many of my patients, there are no less than 10 of these 100-plus factors that are contributing to their disease. I never give them a target BMI because BMI is not based in medicine or science. It is based upon the Metropolitan Life Insurance tables from the 1940s, where white individuals were assessed for their risk of dying based upon their weight status.
So I'm going to stop you there because I want to underscore that, Dr. Stanford, because many focus on BMI to this day. You're saying that that's kind of a random, arbitrary, what's that when somebody does insurance? I can't remember the word of what
actuarial.
That job. Actuarial.
So, yeah,
it's an actuarial standard, not a health standard.
Absolutely. So I think of BMI as a screening tool, not a diagnostic tool. It gives the population-wide view. But when I'm working with an individual patient, and you can ask any of my over 3,000 patients, I never give them a target weight, much to their dismay. They come in asking me, what weight should they be? And I say, whatever the happiest, healthiest weight is for you, based upon us maximizing and optimizing your health.
Okay.
That deviates from what we typically hear, because we do have this hyper-focus on a value that's not founded or based in science.
So I find that, again, also, and I do, our listeners, we had a lot of people text in. I used one voicemail, but in honor of our listeners, a lot of people spoke very vulnerably, right, to us. And I appreciate that so much. I hear you. You know, I went on my first diet when I was 10. I have spent my entire life not feeling good about myself, no matter where I've been, right? And I think many people can identify with that. So, Rachel, I'll come back to you as we wrap this, and clearly this is something we could talk about for 3 hours. Help people who are listening. So Dr. Stanford has given us a reframing of how we understand our health. So now you give us a positive reframing of how to love ourselves in the moment we're in.
Mm. Well, that's something that I think about and have to work on every day for myself. And my view around health and wellness and self-love is trying to be as aware and honest to the present moment as you possibly can. Because so many pieces of ideas and thoughts and perspectives, they get, you know, muddied up in our own minds. But what is true about our bodies is that they don't lie. And this is at the heart of my study with self-love and yoga and wellness, is that a self-trust around the body is something that can bring us into a portal of self-love. Meaning, if we can learn how to be with ourselves, with our breath, with our just physical body, it opens up so many more opportunities to feel that sense of agency, right? Because you can throw out all these numbers, and then the same thing with people have wishes and dreams to change their lives for the better. Without taking that sense of ownership and agency, it's impossible to do that. And that all comes down to self-love and acceptance. So being true and honest to yourself, to your realities, to your health needs, to your personal and emotional, social, spiritual needs, that is also the instrument of well-being.
So Dr. Stanford, I'll come back to you. That sense of self-agency, that sense of being at peace with where you are in the moment to make healthy changes if one needs to, does that resonate for you in working with patients? And maybe just a couple of sentences as we wrap here.
Absolutely. I think the key thing to notice that when patients come to me, they've done whatever they can do to maximize their health. They often need additional strategies for me to affect their actual biology, to change and make it such that it's not such a struggle from day in and day out. But like I tell you, I want them to get to the happiest, healthiest weight for them. They are not, unless they're an identical twin, striving to be like anyone else. And that is, I think, really one of the key things that I want to get across. Health is important. Unfortunately, obesity is a disease that affects almost half of our population. But with that, we can be our happiest, healthy selves and recognize that we are not all the same human. We're heterogeneous. Each person should be valued.
All right. Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford is one of the leading researchers on obesity with MGH and Harvard Medical School. And Rachel Estapa is a wellness influencer and founder of More to Love Yoga. Thank you both for engaging in this subject with us and doing some reframing. Rachel, thanks for being in the studio. Dr. Stanford, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, imagine you are in middle school. Now, I know if you are not in middle school, you may not want to go back and reimagine being in middle school, but try. Imagine you're in middle school where every day feels like a catastrophe. So to be prepared, you carry around a book with instructions on how to survive various calamities, how to outrun killer bees, for example, or how to survive crawling out of quicksand. But what if that book didn't have any suggestions to survive what's happening in your own life? That is the premise of Worst Case Colin, a new book for middle grade readers. So that's readers aged about 8 to 14 from local author Rebecca Caprera. And on top of it all, by the way, the book is in verse. We're going to talk about all of that. Rebecca is here in Studio 2 with us now. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I kind of fell in love with Colin. So tell us about Colin.
I'm glad you feel that way. I feel so connected to him, almost as though he's, you know, my own child. He is a boy who has a lot of anxiety, you know, and it comes from a good place. He experienced, you know, a fluke loss of his mother a few years prior to when the book takes place. And so he can't help but wonder what would have happened differently had someone been better prepared. And so he takes it upon himself to memorize these chapters in this worst case scenario handbook that you mentioned so that if, you know, catastrophe strikes again, he is ready. And of course, this earns him the nickname of Worst Case Colin. But his father is, you know, a loving parent and a gifted mathematician, but he copes with their loss in a very different way. He has compulsive hoarding disorder, and that begins to spiral out of control. And so Colin really has to figure out how to navigate these situations that, like you said, don't come with an instruction manual. And I think ultimately, as the book progresses, he comes to understand that sometimes the bravest thing that we can do is to reach out and ask for help, which is not always easy.
Yeah. You know, it's striking. There were pieces of it where I thought, but of course, right? So you talk about how anxious Colin is, and we know the level of anxiety and depression that young people, adolescents, nationwide and here in the Commonwealth have been experiencing both before, but especially during and as we are maybe moving out of the pandemic. I thought the hoarding disorder piece, choosing to bring that into the mix as well, was really interesting. So why that of all things for a way for his father to be sort of letting him down or not there? And what did you want to accomplish by bringing that into the mix?
Sure. It's a topic I've been interested in for a long time. It's something I hadn't seen depicted in children's literature a whole lot. There are some books. Ellie Swartz has a book called Give and Take, and there are a few others that I'm aware of. But it was something that, as I dove into the research portion of writing the book, I was even surprised by the prevalence of hoarding disorder. Recent studies say that, you know, between 2 and 6% of the population may struggle with hoarding disorder. And a lot of those affected are kids like Colin, who have to learn to navigate kind of this daily risk of physical and psychological harm. And so I thought a lot about, you know, Colin's number one need and want in the book is breathing room, right? He wants space to sort of figure out who he is, and he needs, you know, literal breathing room too in this very clustered, claustrophobic environment at home. And so writing in verse and developing the story with those elements was kind of a rich place to play and explore.
So you just mentioned writing in verse. Mm-hmm. And the format of this book is fascinating, right? It's kind of two pieces. First, it is written in verse, sometimes sort of more traditional stanzas, sometimes kind of visual patterns to help us get the point, you know, access it better.
Right.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. We've got this chapter called Growth, where he's talking about kind of the encroachment of trash, of this hoarding, and the words form. I saw it as a pyramid growing at the bottom. Our producer, Sydney, thought it was the house.
Well, I'm glad it's open for interpretation. So I'm glad that you both had a different reading.
And it communicated to both of us, you know, and I thought when I first heard the book was in verse before I started reading it, I thought, okay, our kid's going to read a book written in poetry, but it totally works. So why'd you do it that way? What inspired you to use verse?
Yeah, this is a format that I love. I think that verse novels are wonderful gateways to poetry. I wasn't even familiar with the form until a few years ago. I heard Kwame Alexander, who wrote The Crossover, which won the Newbery Prize, and I heard a keynote speech with him, and he had talked with so much passion about the potential of poetry to connect with young readers. And so after that, I went and read his book and was just blown away by how much emotion and how much, you know, content and character you could fit into a story with such an economy of words. And it seemed like a really interesting challenge. And it also, like you mentioned, it can be a really accessible way for reluctant readers to get into a story, right? You're not overwhelmed by these thick, heavy chapters of prose. And so I think it's really appealing for that way, in that way.
So let's illustrate that actually. So Grow is less than half a page, this chapter,
right,
with this physical shape that we just discussed. We have it here, and I'd like to ask you to read it
for
us.
Sure. And this poem, just to give the reader some context, it happens right after another poem that is quite sparse. So this is very dense on the page in contrast to that intentionally. So this is called Growth. Now the basement fills up. Books and binders jam and crowd already packed bookshelves. Couch cushions hide reams of paper. More magazines and newspapers than any human could read in an entire lifetime collect in piles, heaps, mountains, joined by clothing, both clean and not so clean, that no longer fits in dressers or closets. Then come bins and boxes of items that have nothing to do with mathematics, like scarves and gloves and coupons and cheese graters and broken keyboards. Spills, drips, leaks seep down through each layer, inviting mold and rot to flourish. Dust settles like snowfall, and each day there is less and less and less and less space for me. I learn to tiptoe around the house. There may be something dangerous hiding below the surface.
So that is author Rebecca Caprera reading from her book, Worst Case Colin, which is a new book for middle grade readers. grades, ages about 8 to 14. I mean, when I hear you read it out loud, and I called the chapter Grow a couple times. It is growth. I think of him as growing, you know, throughout the book.
Yes, yeah.
You can hear the poetry in that. You can hear the verse. And that is striking because there is something lyrical. Do you ever encourage kids to read a book like this out loud?
Oh, absolutely. And if you ever have a chance to listen to an audiobook, Elizabeth Acevedo is a young adult author, but she has she reads her own work and performs her work, and it's just so captivating to hear. She's a you know, spoken word poet. And so, yes, definitely read aloud, read it on the page, because like you said, there's some elements that are visual, right? A lot of the concrete poetry that you talked about, the poems that take a certain form, those are intentional. And those are, you know, I'm a visual person. I come to writing from a background in design and architecture. And so for me, playing with the words on the page, the placement of the ink, the white space, it's just an opportunity to add layers of meaning to the story, visual layers of meaning, and reinforce certain themes or elements of the book. And so, and I really credit my editor for pushing me to take that
really
form.
To really do that.
Yes.
And that gets us to the other piece of formatting of this book, which is unusual, which is these pages. We have these pages inserted out throughout. These are supposed to be from Colin's journal of these worst-case scenarios,
right?
Like number 558 is starvation, right? We talked about running from killer bees or quicksand. It's almost comic relief. They're adorable, right?
Yes.
And he's very serious about, you know, laying out what you need to do to be safe. But they also just underscore this kind of franticness of a kid trying to keep the world from attacking him.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned the sort of the comic relief. Some of them are quite serious and happen at moments, you know, that resonate with other things. But there is an... you know, I think when you're dealing with a book that has heavier subject matter, it's especially for middle grade readers, it's so important to keep a certain levity, right? So there's humor, there's friendship, there's these chapters, these disaster chapters that are so far-fetched. You know, none of this stuff is ever going to happen, hopefully. And I think just keeping those hopeful elements, especially for readers within this age range, just it makes a lot of sense. It's important to me as I'm crafting a story with some tougher topics.
So we've been talking about your book, Worst Case Colin, which I read in one sitting.
Oh, I think that's wonderful.
Thoroughly
Versus
enjoyed.
Versus a quick read. Yeah,
it is. And it's interesting. You run a group for middle-aged. I got to say that correctly. Middle grade readers. And you actually brought us some other recommendations, including a few from local authors. I think, you know, going into summer, school will end soon. Let's play around with that a little bit, too. Let's talk about some of these books that your readers have really enjoyed or that you're preparing to read. You pick one to start.
Sure. So this is, like you mentioned, I run the middle grade book club at a wonderful independent bookstore in Acton, Mass. Called The Silver Unicorn. We've been doing this now for about 3 years. They're just creating such a fantastic community around books, and I'm glad to volunteer and be a part of that. So one of our group's favorite books is a book called Samira Surfs. It's also in verse. It's written by Roxana Guidreau, and it is the journey of a young Rohingya girl who is fleeing Burma and resettling in a refugee camp in Bangladesh. And one of the things I especially loved about our conversations surrounding this book were the fact that the kids were able to make certain connections to other books we'd read previously, in particular When Stars Are Scattered, which is a graphic novel by Victoria Jameson and Omar Mohammed. And that is a story of two Somali refugee brothers who are settled in Kenya. And another story called The Night Diary by Vera Hirandani. And that follows a young girl, a Hindu girl, fleeing Pakistan to India in the 1940s. And so it was interesting to me that the kids, all on their own, made these connections to other books that we had read. It opened up so much, you know, dialogue. Even though the children in these stories are experiencing very different things than the kids in our group are, I feel like these stories helped build a lot of empathy. We talked about activism. It got them thinking about things they could do in their own community. And it was just really beautiful. I mean, I'm sure you know the news cycle can be a little grim at times.
Yes.
And sitting down and sharing an hour with these young people once a month, it sort of renews my sense of optimism about the world. So I'm grateful to them for that.
So for listeners who might have been frantically writing down or trying to write down all those names and those authors, I will say you brought us a beautiful long list. We will have all of it on our website at radioboston.org for people to come back to and revisit. I do want to ask about one just because the title grabbed me, which is My Life is a Potato by Ariane Costner.
Yes. So we talked about the need for levity and laughter. And let me tell you, writing funny books for kids is hard. There's no tougher critic than a middle schooler, right? They will tell you if you are, you know, trying too hard. And this book, I think we read it right in the midst of kind of the height of the pandemic, and we just needed to laugh. You know, the kids vote on the choices. I present them with a short list each month, but they have the ultimate say in what we're reading. And we all were just craving something funny. And this is a story of, you know, moving to a new town, reinventing yourself, and a boy who accidentally becomes his school's potato mascot. They are the Spuds. And it's a great, fun read.
All right. So you've talked about a balance here, right? Some very serious issues, some fun reads. I'm sure there are a lot of people who wonder, how much do you engage with a kid who's 10 or 11 or 12 about what they're reading, and how do you do that? So advice or guidance for people who want to read alongside their young person or aren't really sure, do I let them process that book alone, or is this a time to have a conversation? With my son, I used to often read what he was reading so I would know what was going into his head at that age. Talk about that a little bit.
You know, it's. I think it depends on the child. I have a 9-year-old, and she's recently joined our book club. And sometimes she likes to read on her own, and sometimes we read the books together, family read aloud chapter by chapter, which is fun because then my 6-year-old can also join in. And you know, some of the books do deal with certain topics that they have questions about, and I'm always very open about that. I think that a book is a wonderful place to kind of practice readerly consent. This is an idea that author Alana K. Arnold has talked about. And if a child encounters something that makes them uncomfortable, they can close the book and they can step away and they can come back to it at a later time. And I think there's sort of a simple power in that. And, you know, I think we shouldn't shy away from having these difficult conversations potentially with kids, because a lot of the things in these books, whether or not they're dealing with these issues at home, they might know a friend that is, or it just might help them be a more empathetic, understanding, you know, citizen of the world.
Amazing that books can do that for young
people. Yes,
yeah. All right, so in like 3 sentences, give us one more you recommend.
Okay. Oh, this is so hard. I'm going to shout out to a local author. This is a book called Turn the Tide by Elaine Demopoulos. It's about eco-activism and plastic pollution, and she's a former writer-in-residence at the Boston Public Library. She teaches in town. She's wonderful, and I think this book would be a wonderful gateway to all kinds of conversations about the environment.
Fantastic. So that is Rebecca Caprera, leader of the Silver Unicorn Middle Grades Book Club in Acton, Massachusetts, and author of the middle grades novel in verse, Worst Case Colin. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And again, we'll have those recommendations on our website at radioboston.org so that you can visit them and make your own list. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.